Hello, gentle listeners. What follows is an interview with Edward Butler on the mind-bending subject of the One and the Henads in Proclus, coupled with some reflections and dialogue on the subjects of polytheism and monotheism. Edward Butler has been one of the most penetrating thinkers working on this subject in recent decades, and we're delighted to have him as a guide on these metaphysical terrains which, perhaps because they are so utterly simple, are so utterly baffling. He also has some very interesting things to say about polytheism. Dr. Butler was exceedingly generous with his time and expertise, however, and this interview stretches past the two-hour mark, so I have divided it into two sections, the first devoted to the nature of Proclus's henads, and the second to questions of polytheism, monotheism, and related themes. As will become clear, this is really just a single discussion divided somewhat arbitrarily into two. Really, the themes discussed all flow from a single source, the nature of Proclus's highest divinity or divinities, which is a proper way for a Proclean discussion to unfold. I'm sure you'll agree. Nevertheless, I think that the division isn't completely arbitrary. Indeed, the two parts might perhaps be seen as particular instances of discussion on our chosen theme. Like the henads, parts one and two are both all in all, but each in its own particular way. One other thing. As sometimes happens, the powers which govern digital matters, one assumes this must be Hermes, god of communication, trickery, and lies, but it's hard to say for sure. At any rate, these powers often intervene at what seem to be poetically apposite times. For example, cutting off internet connections for no apparent reason at a particularly poignant or dramatic moment. This happens in this interview right at the beginning, and I've left it in the edited episode. You'll see why. We return to this intervention by someone, if that's what it is, at the end of part two. And now, enjoy Edward Butler on Proclus, Part 1, Henadology. So, hello, this is The Schwepp, and today we're speaking with Edward Butler, a scholar of Platonism, Neoplatonism, and a general philosopher of and thinker about polytheistic religion, a man who knows a thing or two about the One in Proclus. Or we could say, a man who knows a thing or two about the henads in Proclus. And we might be saying the same thing. Or the difference between the two might be infinitesimally small. We'll get to that. Edward, thank you so much for coming on The Schwepp. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for your persistence in getting me to do the show.
It happened. It happened in the end. That's all that matters. So, Doctor, I think more than most discussions on this podcast, this one needs a kind of apophatic proviso right at the beginning, because we're proposing to talk about a realm of conceptualization, which Proclus himself explicitly numerous times says cannot be talked about, right? So there's going to be a hell of a lot of apophatic qualification and hedging around any kind of statements we make metaphysically in this interview. Like if I ask you, what does Proclus say the One is? You immediately have to say, well, he doesn't say it is anything, right? In fact, it definitely isn't anything. But then what does that mean? These kinds of things are going to come up. Are you still there? You've gone dead at my end. Maybe this is the computer expressing an apophatic pact, which is pretty dang appropriate. I might have to even just leave this in the podcast. Little silence never hurt anyone. I'm recording again. We just got disconnected, and I think it might be
The gods are just having a bit of fun with us.
Well, especially because I talked about the apophatic, and that, of course, leads to, philosophically, silence, right? And so it's like, okay, you want to talk about silence?
Yeah, maybe. I'd have a different interpretation, but that would be a matter for a discussion of practical theurgy, I think.
Okay, interesting. Well, maybe we'll come back to that.
We'll see.
Yeah. It seems to me that, well, having made an apophatic proviso that, you know, things are going to be getting into realms where linguistically we're probably not going to be doing justice to the concepts we're talking about. Let me start with a completely impossible to answer question, or maybe you don't think it is impossible to answer, to start out with, to give us something to, some non-thing to talk about. What is the one for Proclus?
The one is the principle of individuation.
What are the henads for Proclus?
They are the absolute individuals.
Right.
They are the prime individuals, the ultimate units.
And you take it, I believe, from what I've seen of your work, that the one for Proclus, the one itself, as opposed to the henads, insofar as that's a meaningful statement, as distinct from the henads, in as much as that's a meaningful statement, is nothing but the principle of individuation. Simply that.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I think that at any rate, given the kinds of apophatic constraints, I think that it is helpful, let's put it this way, I think that it's helpful to have a reading out there that errs on that side, in that direction, rather than the standard contemporary reading, which errs in the direction of reifying or hypostatizing the one itself. So, you know, let me put it that way and perhaps distress people a little less than I usually do with the kinds of things I say on the matter.
I'm happy for you to distress people as much as you want, but I like that that answer. It's something to be getting on with. How, I ask, I wonder, would you characterize the difference between Plotinus's take on the one and Proclus's? And this is the background of my question, the reason I ask it at this juncture, because you have said distressingly to some people in an article that first came out in 2005, which I believe is anthologized in your book of essays on Proclus's theology, quote, "There is no such thing as the one itself, if we mean something different from the henads. Godhood is nothing but the gods themselves," right? Now,
yes.
There is also no such thing as the one in Plotinus. He makes this very, very clear. And he's very adamant and recurrent and persistent in his apophatic unsaying of the one, while also regarding it as the good, as regarding it as the ultimate goal of erotic longing, the sometimes as the beautiful itself, drawing on the Symposium of Plato. So the one is also definitely not a thing for Plotinus. And yet, I can't help but feeling that there are differences in their approaches here. So I wonder how you would answer that.
Well, I mean, Proclus and Plotinus are very different writers. Their mode of philosophical inquiry is very different. What you get in Plotinus, I think, are a lot more what we could term phenomenological inquiries that will deploy concepts in a manner appropriate to the scope of the immediate inquiry. Proclus, as a more systematic thinker, will tend to speak on each occasion in a manner that preserves the relative disposition of different conceptual categories more consistently than Plotinus does. And so there are things then that Plotinus would say that Proclus wouldn't say without a bit more conceptual scaffolding around it than you'll get from Plotinus.
Or a lot more. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Plotinus is also, he's a voluminous and discursive writer. And so, I mean, Proclus's formulations are often more economical in a certain respect. And they're often intended to do duty as philosophical definitions, somewhat more so than Plotinus' concepts. So, I mean, I think that it's a little bit difficult to just map the one onto the other and expect a simple correspondence. But I think that also there is a legitimate tradition of interpretation that links Plotinus to Proclus. And I think that it's appropriate to consider that process of unpacking the significance of Plotinus's work as being something continuous and something that doesn't sharply diverge into a sharply different direction, but which does take up certain kinds of issues, certain kinds of questions that might not have been thematic all the time for Plotinus. And so, you know, I mean, I don't feel that there is a sharp difference between them. And I mean, I feel that if you look at the continuity of the Platonic tradition, I mean, I see it as having a fundamental continuity going all the way back to Plato and the early Academy, and going through even the very kind of different formulations that you get in Middle Platonism and then into Plotinus without, you know, and then into the later, the Athenian Neoplatonists. I don't see that we have to posit any breaks there. Let me put it like that.
Right. Do you think we need to posit a break when you get to a John Philoponus or an Origen or other Christian?
Yeah, I think that Christian Platonism is a horse of a different color. Okay. I mean, I've written about Plotinus's critique of the Gnostics, and of course, at the time that he's writing, as Porphyry, you know, makes clear, the term is referring indifferently to Christians of his time as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I think that his arguments are very salient. His arguments against the Gnostics, the people who he says contract the divine into one. I think that these are cogent arguments, and they're important enough to merit saying that Christian Platonism, because of its monotheism, is fundamentally different than the Platonism which had come before and that which comes after, which of course finds itself increasingly in a polemical conflict with Christians attempting to appropriate the legacy of Plato or simply attempting to silence the voice of Hellenic philosophers in general.
Right. Well, generally also still trying to steal Hellenic philosophical ideas at the same time for their theological notions. Just saying, yes, that that's, I mean, not what they're doing, but doing it anyway.
In a way, one could say that there is a kind of a parallel supersession going on, that there's simultaneously a theological supersession of Judaism that's constitutive of Christianity, and also a philosophical supersession of Hellenic philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could, in some ways, compare the two cases.
Right.
Because I think that in appropriating philosophical arguments concerning the principle of individuation, concerning the unity of being, and using them for monotheist apologetics, I think that the value of these concepts changes mm-hmm. in a way that makes them no longer functionally identical to the concepts that were used before, and the way that these concepts continue to be used by later pagan Platonists in antiquity.
Mm. Now, Plotinus has some other critiques of the so-called Gnostics, notably that they, in his view, unnecessarily promulgate loads of hypostases and structures within the divine realm, the pleroma. And this is a side issue, but surely if Plotinus had been faced with the Platonism of Proclus, he would have said, oh, you're doing the same thing as the Gnostics are doing in this respect, right?
Oh, no, I would disagree.
Okay, and how so? And,
I mean, again, I would have to refer to an article that I published a few years ago called Platinian Henodology.
Yes.
I think that the proliferation of hypostases by the Gnostics is a problem because it's not anchored dialectically, but rather psychologistically. It's purely experiential.
Right, okay.
And I think that this is the problem that Plotinus has, and I don't think that he would have the same problem with the articulation of hypostases by subsequent generations of Platonists in the effort to arrive at a more specific dialectical determination of
I see what you're saying
of the nature of being.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
And so I don't think that he would see these as the same phenomena, as phenomena of the same kind.
Got it. So in other words, it's not the mere fact that they have a whole slew of different names for different levels of divine reality, but the way they come to these conclusions is just wrongheaded.
I have argued that the core of Plotinus' critique of the Gnostics is that they are psychologizing.
Which is a very, very interesting argument.
Yes, it's a term that then that I think is helpful in terms of looking at the Gnostic tendencies in modern and even contemporary thought as well. But that would get us rather far.
That is a very interesting inquiry, which I fervently hope we have a chance to get into at some point. But definitely outside the scope of what we're trying to talk about today. So relevant to the current political scene in the United States, it seems to me. But that's another story, as you say. So we have Plotinus. If there is anything you can say about the one in Plotinus, you can say that it is not in any way plural, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, based on his critical reading of the Parmenides of Plato and numerous arguments. A key difference between the nous and the one for Plotinus is that the one not only isn't plural, but excludes in its nature. He sometimes talks about the one's nature. He doesn't have a word like hyperxis that Proclus can lean on to speak about the existence of something that isn't, that doesn't exist in the sense of being. But he says its nature sometimes excludes the actual possibility of plurality. So it's as it were, ontologically prior to any dyad, right? Now, doesn't Proclus's notion of the henads bring some form of plurality into the one? Or into the...
No, I mean, the importance of the concept of the one has always been that it is the cause of ones. Just as with all Platonizing, formalizing language, when we speak of an eidos of any kind, we're speaking about the cause of the relevant domain of objects. And so the one is the cause of ones. It's the principle of individuation. Mm-hmm. It's the cause of units. And so to then speak about what kind of units there are isn't undermining the nature of the one. It's what we're supposed to be talking about when we're talking about the one. Just as when we talk about soul, we're talking about souls.
Right.
We're talking about the properties of souls, qua soul.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we talk about the properties of units, qua units, we talk about the one. And this naturally excludes plurality, not in the sense of a headcount of a number of entities involved, but it excludes plurality in terms of making each thing to be one thing and not to be many things, because that would be the work of a different principle.
Got it.
And so I think that there's a lot of basic logic involved here that gets obscured a bit if we assume that what is going on is some sort of more exotic apophansis than is actually required. I mean, the difficulty in speaking about the one is because when we speak about things, we have to generally speak about them not only as a unique individual or a unique unit, but we also have to speak of them as a kind of thing. And therefore, in terms of various different pluralities that are associated with that unit.
And the one
the activity of that unit,
yeah,
you say.
Yeah.
And so the difficulty in speaking about the one is not so, it's not necessarily so exotic as it might seem when we bring in sort of rather lofty, religiously flavored language. That by virtue of which each thing is one thing,
yeah,
is indeed an object worthy of awe. It is indeed at the heart of what religion is. But because of the legacy of the monotheist appropriation of the concept of the one, where it's no longer doing the conceptual work of a principle of individuation anymore, it's now standing for a reified absolute divinity that is apophatic by a kind of pure eminence, rather
right.
than for rather specific logical reasons.
I definitely see what you're saying there. Yeah, apophatic just because it's so great. It's greater than anything you can possibly imagine or put into words, rather than
right.
It's very hard to grasp because it is an underlying principle simply of individuation in all things, whereby...
Yes. And so the difficulty is the very difficulty that applies to speaking about any individual as unique. The question is of uniqueness.
Okay. I think I see what you're saying there. However, I have trouble with the relationship between the henads and the one in Proclus. And, I mean, there is no relationship with the one. It is unparticipated, right? But yet the henads are described as being around the one, right? I mean, Proclus, and I'm going to give Proclus full leeway here in terms of he's well aware that natural languages like Greek are not going to do justice to these kind of extremely abstract realities. But he must have a reason for saying that the henads are around the one. And the henads are...
That's a rather unusual formulation of his, but
yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, it's... When a formulation is unusual in his work, it could be more useful to look at it in the specific context of the passage, because, I mean, when he uses around language, That's often because he's speaking about a phase in the activity of the henads in which there is some kind of ideal motion implied. For example, and I think that I could be mistaken, but I think that that kind of language about being around the one comes up particularly probably in the context of the intelligible intellective order, in which we get the emergence of a spatiality among the henads. And the movement of the henads then has to be described in terms of not being around any intelligible object, or a fortiori, any inner cosmic
right.
object or location. And so it has to be about the one itself. But that's to say that it is about themselves. Because, yes, it's a motion around the cause of their own each being one. And this gets into the question of the interpretation of the Phaedrus and what's happening when the gods gather there in the place beyond the heaven. The emergence from that gathering of all of these virtues that then souls experience to the degree that they're capable and propagate on their own plane of being. And so the importance always of these principles is in the procession as it unfolds.
Right.
And so the causality at every stage looks back at the causality up to that point and looks back to its own sources. Now, I mean, since the gods are the original beings, the prime beings.
But they're not beings, though, are they?
No. They produce being.
Right.
But they produce being by producing themselves as beings.
Okay.
And yeah. So they undertake an analysis of their own causality, of their own production as they produce. In fact, that's the mode of their production, is yeah. this self-analysis. And that is, in effect, a motion about the one.
So, although the henads and the one, or the hen, let's just say the the reality which can be described as one fully, so that in encompassing both the one and the henads, although this reality goes beyond ontology in the strict sense, I'm going to use the term ontology here in the sense of existence, right?
I do frequently.
Great.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Are the henads ontologically coeval with the one, or do they somehow come after the one? Now, seemingly, they are ontologically coeval with the one. But at the same time, you're saying that they kind of look to the one in some sense as their cause. There's a playing out of cause and effect, or hyper-causal,
Well, to be specific, the one, according to Proclus, doesn't exercise any causality as such. And so what we really have is that we have a manifold of uncaused henads,
right?
Who also are self-begotten in the sense that they unfold through an analysis of themselves the structures that subsequent beings participate, mm-hmm. and by virtue of which they are being. And so, essentially, the relationship between the one and the henads is best understood as something that emerges at the furthest point of this analysis, at which point it becomes possible intellectively to distinguish unity from being as a cause. And so in many ways, we can't really speak about the one itself until we're looking retrospectively at the entire procession of being. Mm. Because, for example, we really, in order to be speaking about the one itself, need to be able to speak about the ones that are prior to being and the ones that are inferior to being. In other words, we need to be able to speak about the atomic individuals in infima species, below the forms, the lowest participants
right.
of any given form, and the singulars prior to being, and see the activity of the principle of individuation in both of these, bracketing, so to speak, the whole domain of formal unity, which is the domain of being proper.
Right.
And so, in many ways, to get the full chain of hypostases that, you know, that we see in diagrams, in books, and so forth.
Yeah.
We have to be looking at the system from exactly the standpoint that we have as mortal souls and intellects,
right.
Embodied intellects. It's from that perspective that we can unfold the full chain of hypostases. Because if we were doing it from a different point in the procession, not only would there be possibly fewer terms, there would be different terms. And the entire reconstruction of the procession would be different. If, for example, this is going to get rather technical, but I mean, there's the domain of intelligible forms in Proclus, which insofar as they can be distinguished from intellective forms, they're often referred to by him using a term from the Chaldean oracles, pagai, sources.
Yeah, springs.
Springs, yes, you know, fountains,
yeah.
You know, metaphorically speaking. And these typically are the virtues. And so from the perspective of, from a purely ethical perspective, if we were reconstructing the sources of being purely from the vantage point of attempting to live an ethical life and to theorize that life, then there would be a way in which we would talk about the entire procession of being that would look quite different than the one that we would put together in a different dialectical context. With a different, with a different project that we were striving to accomplish, different principles that we were attempting to participate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that rather than looking at the system as this kind of static object, I think in order to really understand what's going on, we need to see it more dynamically and understand that it's different at different stages of the procession. Because otherwise, I think we're stepping outside of the procession, and we're not recognizing it as the encompassing structure that it is, and therefore, in a sense, we're not taking the system on its own terms.
Right. Or could I rephrase it in terms of participatory metaphysics, in the sense that if you're looking at the metaphysics and even physics of Proclus, because he mm-hmm. you can't really distinguish. There's a flow across this supposed boundary between right. physics and metaphysics, as he explicitly sure. says in the Timaeus commentary. If we're to look at this metaphysical structure as an object, I mean, we're obviously going to run into numerous problems from a kind of logical perspective, because we're in the system, right? Our own souls are part of it, so
right.
we can't, you right. know, really get outside it. But also, it itself demands or kind of states that the activity of our souls in doing things like looking at metaphysics or considering realities is part of the process of reality that we're looking at. It's
yeah, and I mean, to give a more concrete example also, I mean, we find in certain Platonic authors the notion of two different paths of reversion upon one's principles. The eidetic and what we might call the theurgic or the synthematic. And in this fashion, you know, I mean, one can speak of two different things when you talk about the attempt to return to one's principles or to turn back upon and to behold one's principles, this Platonic notion of epistrophe, turning back upon. We could be talking about two different things. We could be talking about the attempt to reconstitute by a series of conceptual categories that which our present existence entails. Or we could be talking about our relationship with some god or gods by virtue of which we have a direct experience of the whole of being in the person of the god.
Mm.
And part of why we have this kind of complicated structure regarding talking about the first principle, talking about the one, about the principle of individuation, is because things need to be individuated in very different ways. And the major difference is in the individuation of unique persons like the gods or like the unique person that I am, or the individuation according to forms, which can always be specified further, but never to the point that they aren't subject to iteration. And these two kinds of unit, which we may associate on the one hand with the supra-essential, with the beyond of being, and on the other hand with the ontic as such, with the domain of being as such.
Mm-hmm.
It's primarily this difference between these two kinds of units that requires us to take a great deal of conceptual care with regard to how we speak about the principle of individuation, because we have to speak about it in a way that that retains the sense of the capacity to individuate both kinds of unit, the theological and the philosophical perspective.
Right. Although the way you put it before is much more precise, but in layman's terms, yeah, the theological and the philosophical, indeed, because
that is the exact terminology though that Proclus will often use.
Yeah,
he will say, you know, speaking theologically, speaking philosophically. And when we speak theologically, we use proper names. When we speak philosophically, we use philosophical concepts. And concepts are translatable. Proper names are not, strictly speaking, not qua proper names.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
And so he will actually use this terminology. And of course, people will always expect that the philosophical concepts must be higher themselves ontologically than the proper names. But in fact, just the reverse is true.
Agreed.
The philosophical concepts are indefinite,
mm-hmm,
the way Proclus describes them. He describes them as indefinite. It is the domain of proper names of unique individuals, which is higher because it expresses more of the causality of the principle of individuation, which is the first principle.
Right.
And therefore such entities are ontologically prior when taken in to the degree that they can be taken in their uniqueness.
Hmm.
Now, obviously, for a being such as myself, it's very difficult to speak in terms of my uniqueness. And I mean, you can see 20th century existentialist philosophers wrestling with the difficulty of speaking about myself as a truly unique individual. And, you know, if we look at their struggles, we could gain, I think, a better perspective on this whole question of apophansis. What is actually making it difficult? What's making it difficult is to speak about things qua unique. And in order to speak about the kind of individual that I am, of course, we have to speak about all kinds of other individuals in which I participate and that play a large part in making me what I am. But who I am is in some sense the sum total of that. And hence we can speak of a one of the soul, a one of the entire person, the entire being, as Proclus says.
Mm. And you could also go down in a ontologically downward direction from the unity that is Edward Butler and look at the parts of Edward Butler's body, for example, and then you can chop things up even further.
Right.
And it fragments further down ontologically.
Right. Yes. And I mean, already in Plato's day, you know, you see Socrates saying in a couple of dialogues that there are serious and unserious ways to take up the problem of the one and the many.
The sophist. Yeah. And elsewhere.
Right.
Yeah.
The late learner, as he refers to them somewhere. Paradox mongers.
Right.
Who want to go straight to a kind of a totalizing unity or straight to an utterly atomizing infinity.
Yeah.
Whereas what Socrates in the Philebus is at pains to say is that serious inquiries involve a determinate multiplicity.
Yes, agreed. Another way I've often thought of it is Plato finding a philosophy that doesn't fall into the absurdities either of Heraclitus / the atomists or Parmenides, read a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, although, I mean, Plato always holds open the potential that Parmenides is not to be understood as what some contemporary thinkers have referred to as a block monist.
Agreed.
Because you have this very trenchant statement by Socrates at one point where he says that he's never absolutely certain that he's understanding Parmenides correctly, and he doesn't want to foist upon him some interpretation which is just expressing the limitations of his own understanding.
Hmm.
I think that by default we kind of understand the Iliadics by virtue of someone like Melissus. Because there's a kind of a formulation there which we feel like we can dig into, but I'm not sure that that's the correct way to understand Parmenides. That would get us afield, though. I think that people like Patricia Kurd and Morilatos also has this kind of interpretation of Parmenides where what you actually have is a kind of a procedure, a recursive logical procedure, criteria for what a thing must be to the degree that it is, rather than the positing of some particular object that everything is. I think is closer to the mark, and I mean it also gets us closer to the Parmenides of Plato's Parmenides.
Yeah,
not coincidentally.
Yes, and in a way, again, kind of looking at the doxographical tradition, the caricature Parmenides, the one of Parmenides being some kind of weird floating sphere which there is nothing else, is sort of the blockheaded reading of Aristotle, as opposed to Socrates is much more, indeed.
Aristotle is quite appropriately attempting to create difficulties for an interpretation which he feels pretty sure has consequences that even the people who propounded those doctrines would not themselves endorse.
Mm. Yeah,
and I think that's a useful caveat as well with regard to the things that he says about the Platonists of his day. He's often not saying what, in effect, these people would wish to be positing, but what will be the results of their doctrines?
Right.
What will be the results of what they say, which indeed they probably would not prefer?
Hmm. I feel that that is actually an interesting place to segue to the question of polytheism and monotheism, or to segue back to this question, because I feel...